Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the LawCast. This time we're going back to cover The Night of the Skywalkers. It's Starrcade 1986. Kyush, how the hell did they convince Jim Cornette to climb that scaffold?
Dude, I'm not sure how they convinced anybody to climb a scaffold ever at any point. Like, for all, The Night of the Skywalkers is the singular greatest tagline to anything in the history of sports, much less wrestling. The idea of actually doing a scaffold match in front of all of these people with stars on this level, and then to have dumpy ass Jim Cornette swing off the scaffold, assuming he was going to get caught, it's a recipe for disaster that I'm shocked wasn't thought of beforehand.
Oh, man. Yeah, so this is the night of the infamous scaffold match. The Midnight Express versus the Road Warriors. We'll get to that later. We last covered Starrcade 1985, if you go back to a year ago. That's the night Dusty Rhodes appeared to have beaten Ric Flair for the NWA World title, but that was, of course, a dusty finish, and they ended up giving the title back to Flair on a disqualification. So Rhodes spent another 6 months chasing Flair. He finally beat him for the title at the Great American Bash in a steel cage match. I believe that was his third and final NWA championship reign. He only held the belt for a few weeks. You know, Dusty Rhodes is not the kind of character who's going to be a long-term champion. He lost it back to Flair due to horseman-related shenanigans a few weeks after that. And that allowed Flair to move on to his new program for Starrcade, which we'll get to in a second. The other big thing happening that summer was the big best of seven series between Magnum TA and Nikita Koloff for the U.S. title. Magnum was stripped of the title. He struck Bob Geigel, the NWA president, during a brawl after Nikita insulted his mother. So the title was held up. They had a best of seven series for the belt. Koloff won the first three matches. Magnum won the next three. And Nikita won the seventh and final match to become the champion. That would have freed Magnum up to challenge Ric Flair at Starrcade, but, you know, fate intervened. This show is really the story of Magnum TA, the megastar who could have been and never was due to tragic circumstances.
Yeah, we really can't go any further even talking about the show because he looms over it like a gigantic specter. Magnum was, from the moment that they brought him in, Dusty Rhodes had basically handpicked him to be the next guy. They worked together in Florida when they worked together before, and Dusty Rhodes just had this image in his head of like this, like heartthrob babyface, like pure babyface top star, like basically his Hulk Hogan, but like women would actually like him. And he got it. That's exactly what Magnum TA was. Magnum was the only person who beats him for the entire time from the time he comes into Crockett is Nikita Koloff. That feud was enormous. The I Quit match versus Tully Blanchard is one of the greatest matches in wrestling history. He was ready. He was there. The fans were ready for him to be the new fucking top guy. That was supposed to happen tonight. Unfortunately.
Yeah. You can't poke a hole in the guy's game. You know, size, looks, charisma, wrestling ability. I think he could have been a crossover star. Like, I think they had Dusty saw like him not just as a wrestling star, but a movie star. And I think that could have happened.
Yeah, he had started to get like small television appearances here and there. Like, he absolutely had that in him. He was, people called him the Southern Hulk Hogan. And like, he never really got a chance to get to that level. But you have to remember that he was just beginning. Like, he had absolutely everything that you need to be a star on that level. He also had this amazing promo ability where like he would look directly into the camera and speak with like utter sincerity, and like it was genuinely moving to people. Like, he was the perfect babyface, especially for a Southern wrestling promotion. And I agree with you. I genuinely think that he could have been a crossover star, and I don't know that he ever would have been a star on Hulk Hogan's actual level. But I do genuinely think that he would have been the second biggest star in the business and a person who singularly could have carried this company into the future.
Yeah. Here's the other thing. He was only 27 years old at this
point. Dude. Like 27.
He had 15 years left in him. He would have been around into the 2000s in all likelihood.
Yeah, there's a good chance that he was still like when Flair was still wrestling in the Attitude Era, he would have been a younger wrestling around the same time.
He's 10 years younger than Flair.
Yeah, he got his start around the same time as like Jim Duggan and Steve Williams, and they were both still going pretty fucking strong in the late 90s.
Yeah, like this is the ripples of what happened to him. I feel like the Turner Crockett, I feel like Crockett is an entirely different company if he doesn't have his accident. Turner may have never had to buy the company out.
Yeah, let's just go down like the list of some of the ripples. Jim Crockett had started to he expected with Magnum TA on his side and all the money that they were making in this year for the company to continue growing exponentially, which is why he started paying all of this extra money and trying to expand into different territories. When that gets cut out from under him, that's when all the debts start coming due. That's one of the big reasons why the company goes out of business. Let's see, another one. All the pressure that goes on Sting and Lex Luger to be the new saviors after Magnum TA doesn't there, and Barry Windham and Ron Garvin don't work out. Number three, 1987, Starrcade is a huge disaster because no one gives a shit about Ronnie Garvin, and Vince is able to undercut it by putting on Survivor Series. A disaster. Destroys Starrcade forever. Like, these are just three of, the hundreds of what-ifs that cascade away from this.
Yeah. So by all accounts, he was going to win the NWA World title from Flair here at Starrcade.
Jim Cornette actually said, and I think he might actually be right about this, that he probably wouldn't have won it here just so that they could do it around the horn on house shows. And then he wins it at the Bash. That's normally how Dusty did it.
Yeah, that's probably fair. They probably would have fucked him here because that's how Dusty booked.
Yeah, but then he wins it at Great American Bash or whatever. They do a rematch with Flair at 87, and then Flair fucks off and actually gets a break.
But then on October 14th, barely a month before the show, he lost control of his car on a wet road. Car rolled over. I think he hit his head, and he was critically injured. Serious neck injury. He was paralyzed. He survived and eventually regained the ability to walk, but was never able to return to the ring. There was no question his career was over.
A few quick things about that. First one, he was about less than a mile from his house when the accident happened. According to the police, he was not speeding. Yeah. It was just a freak accident on a rain slick road. And his C4 and C5 vertebrae it says literally on his medical chart that they exploded.
Wow.
Which I've never heard before. Like, he was in his car for 2 hours before anyone found him.
It's so remarkable he survived this.
Yeah. They said that if he hadn't been in as good shape as he was in, there's no way he survives. A normal person does not walk away from this.
That is part of it. It sounds like the Ric Flair plane crash, where it's just it would have killed an average person. Yeah. But
there's a lot of stories like that with wrestlers where it's just look, they keep themselves in peak physical condition and that's why they survive, or their neck
they know how to fall. Yeah.
Yeah. But somehow he survives this. And the fact that he was literally walking to the ring and managing 2 years later is one of the great medical miracles. But I can't express to you the reaction that this gets from the fan base of this company, too. There were, I believe, 20,000 people who collected outside of his hotel room. They had to unhook all of the phones in the entire hospital for months because people were calling in around the clock to get updates on Magnum. It was intense. I don't even know who I could compare it to. I was trying to think of a corollary. I guess the closest would be if Austin had been paralyzed when Owen Hart did that pile driver. In terms of somebody who was about to become a gigantic star. But even then, I don't think he wasn't beloved on that level.
No, not. It was a different and less earnest time.
I just can't think of anything that compares to it. To have your hero snatched away like that.
So it's Flair wild. Flair had to sneak into the hospital to go see him. I love it. They still have to keep kayfabe up at this point.
They literally put him in nurse's scrubs and he had to walk in the worker's entrance to get in without people seeing him.
Yeah. So obviously, in addition to this being a terrible tragedy, it also blew up Starrcade because it was going to be Magnum and Flair here. Maybe Magnum Nikita, but I've heard it was going to be Magnum and Flair.
Well, it's also worth mentioning, too, that they hadn't really bothered to have, like, a B babyface set up at this point because they were so definitively going with Magnum.
And they had Dusty.
Yeah. So, like, they weren't really trying to, like, warm anybody up to have in the background because they were just replacing Dusty on top with Magnum on top and putting Dusty in Magnum's spot. So they didn't really think that they had to. But the one match that you can't do again is Flair versus Dusty because you've been doing it for a year straight.
Yeah. So, yeah, you look up and down the card. There's not a ton of options here. They decide to go with Nikita Koloff as the challenger. He's obviously been a mega heel as the evil Russian. He turned face by expressing, you know, his sympathy and respect for Magnum, who he had been feuding with. And that set up the battle against Flair. One thing I had a misperception of, I was always under the impression that, like, the fans accepted Nikita. That is not the case. Like, he is heavily booed here.
It's funny because there were some markets where it did work, and they were mostly – here's the thing. It's in 1986, it was very, very difficult to make quick booking changes and for your whole audience to see him. There wasn't just, like, one weekly TV show that your entire audience watched every week. Like, a lot of your audience was only going to house shows or only watching the pay-per-views. Like, if you were trying to make – and you only had 1 month to make this change. It just wasn't going to get around to everybody that Nikita's suddenly a good guy that you love. And even if you did accept that, it wasn't enough time for you to, like, warm up to him as a babyface, right?
Yeah, like, and they only had a couple weeks to put this together. Like, Magnum gets hurt barely a month before the show.
They actually tried so hard to do this that they went out to, like, the wrestling mags, like the After mags, and, like, they did a bunch of stories. Like, Nikita famously is on the cover of one of them, like a big picture
I cry for Magnum TA.
I cry for Magnum TA, yes.
Yeah.
The first sympathy he's ever shown. Like, and there's something about that I do love. I love the idea that occasionally, like, you fight somebody for so long that you start to love them and respect them. That's okay. Yeah. That's not a bad idea. It's just they didn't have enough time.
No. We've also got the Midnight Express against the Road Warriors in a scaffold match.
Who thought about putting the fucking Road Warriors in this? Why?
And one of them's got a broken leg.
Jesus, why didn't you just put the Rock and Roll Express versus the Wrecking Crew in it and make Ole take the jump off the fucking scaffold?
Yeah, we've also got Rock and Roll Express against the Andersons in a steel cage match, which seems like the ideal tag team title match in the 80s. It's hard to draw up a better one than that.
Oh, yeah, that kicks ass. Like, on a lesser pay-per-view, that could have main evented the Great American Bash. Like, that's really great. And, like, this is basically the year that the Horsemen were founded. Like, this is just when, like, Arn and Ole and Flair and Tully are really starting to get, like, they had already all had heat, but, like, the heat becomes nuclear in 86. So, like, they are awesomely on top at this point.
Oh, so for the second year in a row, they do two venues. We jump back and forth between the Greensboro Coliseum and the Omni in Atlanta. This is the same year the WWF has run WrestleMania 2 in three arenas, which, as we noted when we covered that show, completely sucked. This was something Crockett understood how to do much better, that you just jump back and forth each match rather than do half the show in one place and half in the other.
And one of the cool things about that is for a lot of this show, if you're not paying attention, you wouldn't really know which venue you're at. Like, it just feels like a coherent show.
Yeah.
The only real thing that bothers you is the fact that, like, the announcing is wildly different from match to match.
Yeah.
Bob Caudle and Tony Schiavone are not similar.
The unbelievable thing is this is the last proper Starrcade. The next year, they take it out of the South and try to run Chicago and a series of just disastrous things happen on that show, and Starrcade is never the same again.
We've covered now almost every Starrcade on this show. And I asked Steve before we started recording, like, what name, like, the biggest Starrcades ever, like the ones that really mattered.
Yeah.
And we only came up with like four.
And it's like 83, 85, 86, and then 97. Yeah.
It's and the in between there are good moments, like there's Flair versus Vader and there's like the invasion of NJPW. Like, it's not that all of the Starrcades suck per se. They just don't feel like they matter anymore.
Yeah.
after
this. These were special. Like, there is something in the air here. This was unquestionably the biggest show of the year. It was a cultural event in the South. Like, we're going to have our Thanksgiving, we're going to watch our football, and then we're going to go see the wrestling matches at night. Like, there was something special to this. Families were all going out together to see these shows, and they could never replicate it again after this.
I still hold that there's room to this day. Like, the only thing to watch on Thanksgiving is the parade in the morning, football during the day, and now they finally started putting on the Thursday night primetime game at night, but that game always fucking sucks. There's still room to do wrestling at night to claim that spot.
I feel like every Thanksgiving I text you, man, I wish there was some wrestling on tonight.
Like, I've literally have that spot in my Thanksgiving calendar when I host it is for like rewatching Star Wars. Like, we just watch A New Hope on Thanksgiving Day. That could so easily be replaced by something like this. Like,
man, I wish AEW would move Dynamite to Thursdays just for Thanksgiving. That would rule.
Just do a Clash of the Champions on Thanksgiving night, man. Come on.
Thanksgiving Thunder, baby.
Yes. It's just a good idea. And it's the same thing with, like, Christmas Day. Like, I know you want your people to be able to spend Christmas Day with their families, and God knows I want them to be able to do that, too. But, like, on Christmas Day night, what is there? Nothing. Yeah. You could own that. The NBA took it over, and now it's just NBA Day.
The NBA filled the void there.
Those days where you know everyone's just sitting at home watching TV, that's magic.
Well, it's smart that WWE is running that New Year's show this year.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. So anyway, it's a Thursday, November the 27th, 1986, Thanksgiving night. We are at the Greensboro Coliseum in Greensboro, North Carolina, and the Omni in Atlanta, Georgia. There's about 30,000 people in attendance between the two arenas. I think the Omni was pretty much sold out. I think Greensboro was about 2/3 full because that is a really big building. And then they drew about another 30,000 at the closed circuit locations.
It's actually very funny because the Omni is full of, like, families. When they pan the crowd, there's kids everywhere. Greensboro, every time they pan the crowd, it's just a bunch of single dudes.
Greensboro, I mean, there was a tradition of wrestling in Greensboro too, but yeah, it feels like that's the more hardcore wrestling town. Atlanta, there's the big, they do this big thing Thanksgiving night where they light the Christmas tree downtown.
Yeah.
I think it was kind of like a lot of people would walk right from there over to the arena to go to the show.
Absolutely. There's also a big thing where, like, Magnum is from Virginia Beach, Virginia, which is where I'm from. He's actually the only athlete other than Allen Iverson specifically from where I'm from. So that's why Magnum's always been a big deal to me. But also, he lived in North Carolina. Like, he lived and breathed North Carolina. Like, if he had been on this card, they sell out that arena. There's no question about it.
But unless they flipped it, the title match was in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I didn't even think
about that. Atlanta got the better end of the deal here. They both got the Skywalker match and the title match. I would have probably put the Skywalkers in Greensboro.
Yeah, but I would imagine that for the Omni, they probably had the higher ticket prices. I would have to guess.
Probably.
I mean, you're still getting...
But Greensboro is the bigger arena, even though it's the smaller market.
It's also funny, like, Greensboro gets all the blood and guts matches, it feels like. Yeah. Like, they get the First Blood and the Steel Cage match, because that's more Greensboro. Like, the Omni wants the big match. Greensboro wants the blood.
Yeah. This is an aside, but there is an insane number of gimmicks on this show.
Fuck me. Okay. This show was ridiculous.
Whenever you hear an old timer complain about how there's too many gimmick matches today, just point to a show like this where there's a steel cage match, a scaffold match, a strap match, a blood match.
I just want to point this out.
Street fight.
We have, like, this is one of the most revered and idolized shows in the history of the NWA. This is, and especially if Magnum had been on this show, this would have been the Starrcade of all time. I just want to point that out because there are 1, 2, 3, 4 of what we, Steve and I, personally consider to be the shittiest gimmick matches ever devised in all of wrestling history. All of them are on this show. You got a strap match. You got a hair versus hair match between managers. You got a First Blood match and a scaffold match. All on the same show.
Yeah. Yep. On commentary, we have two different teams. In Greensboro, we have Bob Caudle and Johnny Weaver. in Atlanta, we have Tony Schiavone and Rick Stewart. Which one did you prefer?
Bob Caudle is the best announcer involved in this, but Johnny Weaver is not a good sidekick for him at all. Like, Johnny Weaver's terrible. Like, I liked Schiavone and Stewart just because they had, like, a younger sensibility to him, but I wish the whole time that it was just Caudle and Schiavone. Like, that would have been such a better combination, you know? What about you? Did you prefer Caudle and the old man?
Yeah, I like Bob Caudle. Something about him is just so Southern wrestling to me.
Johnny Weaver fucking sucked, though.
It's pretty bad. Bob Caudle's just like watching wrestling with your grandpa.
Also, I can't get out of it. Isn't Johnny Weaver the one who was on that UWF show that we did?
I don't remember.
I think it was like 6 years later and a whole lot of scotch.
Oh, man. We start off with generic rock music playing over a light show. We can't hear the crowd or the commentators, so this is definitely dubbed in.
Okay, I don't want to be mean here, because somebody worked really hard on this and it's 1986. But you know how we always made fun of TNA for having all sorts of green lasers around in place of actually having good production value? This is where that was born. They are so fucking impressed with their one fucking laser.
This is cooler than anything on these early WrestleManias.
I agree. But it's just so, like, they literally do, like, long lingering camera shots on one singular green laser. It's like, dude, this is sad. Also, and it just must be said, the production on this show is not good. I don't know whether it's because they're splitting it in between the two venues. I don't know. Like, there's a lot of camera snafus, a lot of sound snafus. Like, it's just not great. I don't really know what caused that.
Yeah, probably just that the production is overstretched. And we saw all the issues the WWF had with WrestleMania 2, and that was, the WWF, which is always the gold standard for production.
Yeah, the NWA didn't have the best production people anyway. And if you think about it, they're literally splitting their team in half and then still trying to put on the biggest production show of the year. It's a big ask.
In the opening match, we've got Tim Horner and Nelson Royal versus Rocky and Don Kernodle.
Yeah, Steve, who are any of these guys?
Tim Horner, I remember from Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Jim Cornette has some feud with him. I think Tim Horner stole his copy machine or something.
That's pretty fucking funny. This is one of many matches.
Don Kernodle was a pretty big star when him and Sergeant Slaughter were a tag team. Weren't they in the match that inspired Starrcade?
Yes, they actually were. You're right about that.
Was them against Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood or something like that?
Yes, that is like Don Kernodle's big claim to fame, yes. Is that's the one where they literally had a guy with a stick out front of the Greensboro Coliseum, like, hitting people with it to get him to stop coming in.
Yeah, they were, like, making emergency radio announcements that, like, the show was sold out to tell
people. Please don't come to the Greensboro Coliseum. I swear to God. Yeah, you guys are causing traffic all the way out to Virginia.
And that's what inspired Starrcade. So Don Kernodle was the Johnny Ace of that match.
Yes.
Rocky Kernodle, no idea. Nelson Royal, no idea.
They're just dudes. There's a lot of old-ass looking men on this show.
There's somebody in one of these matches, and we'll get to it. There's somebody who's literally 50 years old.
Yes. I do want to point this out, too, is that, like, I really came to a realization while I was watching this show in particular. But wrestling in general used to be so much more about what people saw from, like, 100 feet away rather than what they saw close up. Right.
That makes sense.
So even if you're an old man, it doesn't really matter. You didn't have to be all trim and buff and whatever. And every heel would wear, like, the sparkliest fucking outfit they could so that you could tell who the heel was from the 30th row back. They didn't have Titantrons, man. You just saw what you saw.
This match was cut from the VHS tape for understandable reasons.
What a shame.
I actually kind of enjoyed this. I thought there were some fun, innovative spots here.
It doesn't suck. Tim Horner's actually pretty decent. Like, his tag team with Brad Armstrong later in his career actually didn't suck. Like, it's okay. I don't know that I would have gone with this as the opener, but book opening matches differently.
This is the thing. This is the old philosophy where the opening match is just something you put on while people are getting into the arena and finding their seats. Like,
which is funny because that's the New Japan way. Like, Dusty booked the same way that New Japan books, which is that you elevate the importance of the match from match to match until you get to the end, which is how I would do it, too. So I completely understand that. This is just some whatever.
This is just filling time.
Yeah.
Horner and Royal get the win with a roll-up after 5 minutes.
Woo!
And then we've got Brad Armstrong against Jimmy Jam Garvin. We jump to Atlanta for this one. Jimmy Garvin incredibly over as a heel here.
My God, he's over. And he's
heat
fantastic.
On this man. Yeah.
Did you know that Ronnie Garvin is his actual real-life stepdad?
No!
I did not know that till I was doing research for this show.
I guess that explains why they have the same... Actually, it wouldn't really explain why they have the same last name.
Yeah, it's stepdad, so I don't really know why. But yeah, I wouldn't have thought that the age difference would be that stark, but it is.
Oh man, that's definitely a stepdad your mom said you didn't have to worry about.
Yeah, this one's all about...
Let's hope the only thing made of stone with him are his hands.
You son of a bitch. They're clearly trying to push Brad Armstrong as like a plucky up-and-coming babyface, and they keep trying to do that for like the next 10 years.
Yeah, this is another one that just feels like it's letting people find their seats. Not a lot of storyline here. Brad Armstrong is great technician, but never found any personality. They go 15 minutes to the time limit. The bell goes right as Garvin comes off the top rope and misses a splash.
I did feel like Armstrong had some good fire here. Yeah. Garvin did some great heel work. Like, there's nothing wrong with this match. Like, this is the kind of match you want on a show like this.
15 minutes is a little long for this.
Yeah. The number of arm drags that Brad Armstrong does in this match is asinine.
Here we can note, this show is a whole 4 hours, and they also cut the intermission out.
Yeah, this is a time... I don't remember if they were really doing four-hour shows around this time or what, but it just feels so weirdly out of place.
It's long. So this went well past midnight.
4 hours is such a fucking taboo length of time, you know? And, like, again, not to keep drumming on this, but I can't not do it. If this show ends in Flair Magnum, that's something you're willing to wait for. What we're actually going to get is not that.
No. They fight a little bit after the match, and Garvin runs away. Next up, we have the weirdest match of the night as Hector Guerrero and Baron Von Raschke team up against Shaska Watley and the Barbarian.
I've mentioned before on this show that, like, I specifically don't look and see what the next match is going to be or, like, who's wrestling on the show. So this whole foursome is like a collection of, wait, that guy? Wait, is teaming with that guy? What the fuck?
Yeah. We have a Nazi and a Mexican as the babyface team.
Yeah, let's be clear. He's a reformed Nazi now.
Yeah. And I'm sure I think Hector Guerrero is actually from El Paso, so he's an American. But, yeah.
Now, I believe originally Baron Von Raschke's story was that he was like a defected Nazi scientist who wanted to bring terror to the Midwest people or something like that.
Nazi heels were big back in the 50s.
But mostly they didn't turn babyface and stick around until they were 80.
Yeah, stay for decades and decades.
Yeah. I will say this.
Wasn't Baron Von Raschke just at the last AEW pay-per-view?
Yes, he was. And he looks the same as he does
he
here.
He wasn't aged. Yeah.
He's Here's just the best part. The thing that always made me laugh about Baron Von Raschke is that he was just a normal Minnesota school teacher. He taught history, okay? So, like, I just love the idea that you would have this guy teach you about World War II, and then you would go to see the AWA show and watch him portray a Nazi scientist.
Yeah. Big highlight here is Guerrero hitting a planche out to the floor, which is not something you expect to see in the 1980s.
Guerrero kicked ass in this match. Yeah, like, he does... Impressed. For 1986, he is, like, blowing the top off the place. People don't even know how to respond to the shit he's doing.
Von Raschke takes the hot tag and then goose steps.
Sure does.
Hard to explain this to a non-wrestling fan.
Then he locks on the Iron Claw.
The Claw.
To the biggest reaction of the night for anything.
Dude, the Claw is over.
Dude. This old ass man locks the Claw on Shasko Watley. And you would have thought, like, it's Austin giving Rock the Stunner.
Nobody gets out of the Claw.
It's just very funny. Also, like, the Barbarian looks exactly the same as he would look for the next 15 years.
Yeah, he doesn't age either.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Barbarian breaks the Claw. Watley misses a headbutt in the corner. And I've got that he gets pinned after an elbow drop by Watley, but that sounds backwards.
Yeah, Raschke hits the incredibly slow falling old man elbow drop.
Knock the wind out of him with that one.
Yeah.
Next up, we've got a no disqualification match for the U.S. tag titles. We've got the Russian team against the Kansas Jayhawks.
Okay. So the Russian team is Crusher, Khrushchev, and Ivan Kolov.
Yeah. Barry Darso.
There have been a lot of fake Russians over the years. It's notable. All the Russians are fake Russians. Like, that's just
none of these people were ever actually Russian.
No, absolutely not. But at least they tried to pretend like they were. Like, Ivan and Nikita went to great lengths to make people think they actually were Russian.
Yeah. I don't think Nikita ever dropped the accent.
No. And, like, not only did he do the accent, like, when people saw him in public, like, he would refuse to speak English to them. Like, it was a big deal to him. Barry Darso puts no fucking effort into this.
No.
Unbelievable. They do a promo later where it's, like, he's literally talking in, like, his North Carolina accent. Yeah, as I said down in Mother Russia.
The redneck Russian. The Kansas Jayhawks are Dutch Mantel and Bobby Jaggers. No idea who Bobby Jaggers is.
I have not the slightest fucking idea.
Dirty Dutch.
Apparently he's Hangman Bobby Jagger, so Adam Page stole his gimmick from him.
Yeah. The Russians work heat on Mantel for a while. They go for a heart attack type move, but Mantel gets the bullwhip. He whips both the Russians and then brawls out to the floor with Khrushchev. Khrushchev manages to hit Jagger with Koloff's chain, and the Russian team get the win and retain the titles.
Let me just pretend to be Jim Ross for a second here and be like, well, you know, King, Bobby Jagger studied civil engineering at Kansas City University.
Very, very intelligent young man.
Absolutely.
This first hour.
It's interminable. Like, dude, there over the course of our podcast, we've done some 200 odd shows, right? Only like 10 of them have the entire time have I been watching a show, have I been like, fucking Steve, I swear to God, he made me watch this bullshit. The first hour of this show is very much on that list.
We had to finish the old school Starcades. We have to.
I know. And the second half of this show rules ass. So, like, I'm not complaining about that necessarily. It just, the first seven matches of this show are absolute trash.
Oh, you didn't want to see an Indian strap match between Rick Rude and Wahoo McDaniel?
This was another one of those things where it was like, it was like a whiplash effect for me. Like, oh, it's Wahoo McDaniel's old ass.
Wahoo was like 48 here.
And it's an Indian strap match. Okay, this is going to suck. And then it's like, ooh, ravishing. And I'm like, wait, what? I was stunned when Rick Rude walked out here because he does such a short time in Crockett. People forget
he's
that
here
he was
for like
there.
6 months. He was in and out real quick before Vince stole him.
Which is, I mean, Vince was a genius to steal him. He's so obviously a star here.
God, how is he this low on the card here?
He could have eventually supplanted Flair as the top heel. Like, he has everything you need right here.
Yeah. Ooh.
Unfortunately, this is a strap match, which is our least favorite kind of match ever, according to the Lawcast.
Rude is managed by Paul Jones. You win by touching all four corners. It's a very plotted match. I was impressed that Rude got to do all the, like, savvy veteran spots with the strap. I would have figured that would be Wahoo's deal.
Yeah, I would have thought so too. Like, I would have thought this would have been about like chicken shit young Rick Rude. How old was he at this point? 86. He was born in 58, so pretty young.
28.
Yeah. He can't definitely should have been doing like the chicken shit heel begging off stuff here instead.
Never should have let him go.
Jesus, that's, if you had had 27-year-old Magnum and 28-year-old Rude, that's the future of your company, bro. Yeah,
that's your next 10 years. Wahoo Blades. Wahoo wins by disqualification, I think, when Jones jumped in the ring and attacked him. What the hell?
Disqualification in a fucking strap match? What?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they don't want to beat Rude, but so just have Rude win. Wahoo's ancient.
Yeah, it doesn't, and like every up and coming heel has beaten Wahoo in the last couple of years. Like even Magnum TA, when he first came in, beat Wahoo clean. Like that's like a rite of passage. Why are we doing this? It doesn't make sense. So as I came into this match, I asked myself two questions. One, is this a good strap match? Because we've only ever seen one of them, maybe.
Shad Gaspard versus JTG.
Yes, the legendary Shad Gaspard. That we got to cover that show someday because we built it up so much.
Rest in peace, and, Shad Gaspard.
That's right. What a hero. And is this one of those matches where Rick Rude is good or one of those matches where he's the worst wrestler who ever walked the earth? And I think this is one of the ones where he's good, even though this is a good match.
Yeah, he did his best.
Yeah.
Then we get an interview with the Russian team. They say they want Dusty Rhodes and that dirty traitor Nikita Koloff next.
I did like the part in this where, like, these guys are still very much heels.
Yeah.
But where Ivan's just like, we're rooting for you, Nikita. We want you to win, my brother. I know you're a babyface now because you respect, and that's fine. You do what you got to do, but you're representing us. So you go out there and beat Ric Flair for that title. I like the nuance there. That's not something you see. And then like Khrushchev was like, you better give me the first title shot. Ain't nobody giving you a title shot, Barry Gunn. So
you're out, you old ass. No.
Also, he's out of the company in like 6 months.
Yeah. He goes off to be part of Demolition.
Yeah.
Next up, the NWA Central States Championship. We've got Sam Houston defending against Bill Dundee. Houston is a plucky Southern babyface. Dundee, very much a Southern heel here with a big beer gut.
Yeah, there are two types of wrestlers in the South. There are young, like teen beat heartthrob babyfaces, and there are old fat men who try to beat them.
Bill Irwin, probably my favorite example.
Yes. Also, Steve, what states does the Central States Heavyweight Championship have jurisdiction over?
I think it's like Kansas, Missouri, maybe Colorado, Nebraska. They bought out the territory. Like this is when they're starting to spend money. They bought the Central States territory out from Bob Geigel.
And like that makes sense, but like the NWA Central States Heavyweight Championship just sounds like shit. Like you need to rename that bell.
Yeah. Dundee dominates for a while. Houston makes his comeback. Dundee gets Houston's boot off and hits him with it. The referee saw it, so it's a disqualification. The dreaded boot shot.
This is the second disqualification in a row. Though the best part about that is Dundee looks at the ref and is like, what? And then the ref is like, you hit him with the boot. And Dundee's like, no, I didn't. And then he immediately hits him with the boot again.
Proceeds to just wail on him with the boot. I don't know. There's something I love about somebody getting beat with somebody's shoe. That's old school.
I fucking love that. And like this
is like something Hall of Pain Mark Henry would have done.
And these boots got some weight to them, man. Like you hear the thud when it hits Sam Houston dead in the ribs.
Next up, we've got a hair versus hair match. Boogie Woogie Man Jimmy Valiant against Paul Jones.
I'm somewhat sympathetic to Dusty Rhodes' plight with Jimmy Valiant. Because it's one of those things where, like, he can't wrestle to save his fucking life. Like, he genuinely can't. But, as you said, he's maybe the most over man in the territory.
A beloved figure.
So you just have to keep finding, like, weird bullshit like this for him to do.
So the stipulation is that if Valiant loses, his manager, Big Mama, who's a very attractive woman, gets her head shaved.
Yes, I When I saw Big Mama was her name, I was not expecting what we got.
No, you were thinking more Mama Benjamin.
I definitely was. I was not thinking like, okay.
Yeah. The Raging Bull is with Paul Jones. I have no idea who this is.
That's Manny Fernandez.
Oh, yes. That's it.
Yes. And like, he kicks ass here. Like, his whole deal is that he will, like, knock you the fuck out. And, like, you get that vibe from him the whole time he's out there. They're putting him in a shark cage and suspending it above the ring.
Takes the entire babyface roster to get him in the cage.
That was my favorite part of this entire match. Is before it starts, Manny Fernandez is like, I don't give a fuck what match you made. I'm not getting in that cage. And every babyface on earth comes down. And he whoops all of their asses until someone, like, trips him into the cage.
Jones works on Valiant's leg until Valiant makes a comeback. Valiant with the sleeper. Jones gets a foreign object out of his trunks, but he drops it. Valiant gets it, hits him with a loaded fist and gets the pin. And then Jones gets his head shaved. Both the Bull and Rick Rude attack Valiant. They proceed to hit some awesome double team moves on him.
Yeah, what the fuck? Like, they were, like, doing some shit, man.
They hit him with a heart attack, then, like, a reverse 3D where they DDT'd him on a chair.
That was, like, I had not seen, like, an orchestrated team move like that ever before this point in history. Like, they were inventing some shit here.
Yeah, you just think they're gonna, like, put the boots to him and, like, maybe punch him a little bit.
Yeah, like, they ruined his shit. I loved that. Also, big ups to Jimmy Valiant. I've seen a lot of hair versus hair matches in history. This is the most efficient I've ever seen someone cut someone else's hair on TV.
Yeah.
Like, he gets it done in, like, 1 minute. It's incredible.
You need those big-ass clippers.
Yeah. And, like, Paul Jones lays perfectly still because Jimmy Valiant's like, I'm taking your fucking hair off. I don't care if you move or not. We got time to hit.
And then we get a ridiculously long promo for the Bunkhouse Stampede.
Okay. This is the worst job of selling a pay-per-view I have. Okay. I want to paint a word picture for you guys. Okay. So they say, like, okay, now we're going to go and hear about the rules to the Bunkhouse Stampede. And then they go to an old man sitting at a fire, like, eating some beans. And he's like, the camera's a little bit far away from him, and it's a little bit dark, and he's talking very quietly, and he's not looking at the camera. And he's just like, sometimes in the West, men would have to live together in a bunkhouse, and they wouldn't get along together too well. And this goes on and on.
He's like, yeah, they'd fight. They'd have to settle things. Sometimes they'd be wearing their jeans, their shirt sleeves.
Yeah, that was the big part. Is like, they'd come as they were. Some would be wearing Daisy Dukes. Some would be wearing flippers.
Their overalls, their long underwears.
The rules to the Bunkhouse Stampede are, it's a fucking battle royal where they wear street clothes. That's all it is. That's all you have to say. It's a reverse
cage match. You have to throw your opponent out of the cage.
Yes, that's all it fucking is.
Stupidest fucking stipulation I've ever heard.
He never mentions the cage part of it either. That's literally not part of his explanation.
Maybe the cage match only came next year when it was on pay-per-view. That may have been the addition.
But literally, he's like, it's the two most dangerous types of matches, a battle royale, and then he pauses, because what he has to say is, well, it's just a battle royale. And just like, and a match with lots of people in it.
Just the longest, most boring cutscene you can imagine from Red Dead Redemption.
And then it just like pops up like, Bunkhouse Stampede. Bunkhouse Stampede is already a stupid-ass concept for a pay-per-view. Yes. This is the worst sell job I've ever seen. Like, I would never watch this show if this is how they're selling.
It's actively, like, reduced my interest in ever watching the Bunkhouse Stampede.
Can you imagine if this commercial had appeared on television and you as a child were watching it and you're like, what the fuck? Like, at no point in this does he mention, like, wrestling or, like, Dusty Rhodes and Ric Flair. Like, nothing. Nothing exciting at all. Just, back in the old country, men would have to bunk next to each other, and they wouldn't get along together too well.
This was definitely Dusty trying to make a movie.
Like, oh, my this fucking was just, God, yes.
This was just a Dusty wank.
He so obviously wanted to get, Like, Sam Elliott didn't exist then in the context that he does now, but that's what he wanted, right? It's just like a Sam Elliott type to be sitting around a fire being like, you probably think you know a lot about the Old West. Well, how about the bunkhouse? A lot of naked men bathing next to each other, stealing each other's soap.
They edit out intermission, and then we do a promo for the Crockett Cup. Good Lord, the promos on this show.
And like,
there's like, I swear, like an hour of advertising future shows or past shows in some cases.
Now, what I will say is I love an intermission. I think that every show that's going to be longer than 3 hours should automatically have an intermission built
in. Oh, yeah. You need it.
Like, every New Japan pay-per-view does this. And the brilliance of that is it's also kind of, not only does it give you a break to kind of like, so you don't treat their matches as a piss break. You have one built in already. And it's sort of like the dividing line. Like, all the stuff before this, that was just for fun. All the stuff after this is the real shit.
Now it's like, getting real.
You can tune in at the intermission and watch the real pay-per-view or enjoy a bunch of the undercarders. You do whatever you want. But after intermission is when it pops the fuck off.
So we come back from intermission for the Louisville street fight between Ron Garvin and Big Bubba Rogers. It's the Louisville street fight because Big Bubba is managed by the Louisville Slugger himself, Jim Cornette.
Now, the interesting thing about this is that if Magnum had been on this show, by the most likely thing is that Ron Garvin would have faced Nikita Koloff. Like, that's what, where they were going with that.
Yeah, sounds right.
So he gets fucked here. Sure. Like, this is not, this is so a lower place on the card than he would have been.
You win this one by pinfall or forcing your opponent down for the referee's 10 count.
Yeah. Big Bubba Rogers is, of course, the big boss man. Who rules, but he is a baby here. Like, he is a child. He's a big, fat child.
Garvin drives Bubba out to the floor with some big right hands. Just crazy heat on this match. Like, this is the kind of thing you only saw in the South.
Yeah. Like, anybody with Jim Cornette is on fire. And considering that Big Bubba Rogers was his enforcer, doubly on fire. And he's got like a solid 8 inches on Garvin.
Bubba takes control. He hits Garvin with a roll of quarters. That's heat in the South.
I think there were like 3 different roll of quarter shots on the show. Like, that was the only, I think that was the gimmick thing that Jimmy Valiant and Paul Jones used too. Like, that was just the thing that everyone used tonight.
I just love when you do it right and the quarters go flying.
Yeah, they just explode everywhere.
Bubba up to the top. Garvin throws him off. That is quite the bump for the big man.
I like that a lot. Fucking Bubba Rogers is like doing huge bumps all over the place in this match.
Garvin covers him. Bubba powers out. Garvin lands on top of the referee, Tommy Young, and knocks him unconscious.
The only notoriously frail Tommy Young. He and Earl Hebner, who are both on this show, by the way, are the only two good ref bump men who ever lived.
Garvin KOs Bubba with the big right hand. Cornette hits him with the tennis racket. Neither man is able to answer the 10 count. Young says there has to be a winner, so the first man to reach his feet will win the match. That's a creative solution to this problem.
Yeah, I actually do like that a lot.
Yeah, good drama. Garvin makes it to his feet, but Cornette distracts the referee and then hits him in the leg with a tennis racket, and Bubba makes it to his feet to get the win.
Did you notice that Cornette literally, like, cocks his tennis racket? Because, like, it's supposed to be, like, a loaded tennis racket. Yeah. But, like, it's unclear in what way it's loaded, but he activates whatever it is by cocking it like a gun.
Like Roman Reigns cocks his fist.
Yeah. And then every time he cocks it, like, the crowd responds like, no, now no! It's magical.
Yeah.
A lot of imagination going on.
The tennis racket is such a perfect weapon. Like, you can hit somebody with it. You're not going to hurt them. On the other hand, like, heat device, but also he could fight the Mark fans with it.
Well, that's the thing. And also, like, people throwing shit at him out of the crowd. He had the perfect thing to hit back at him. Yeah. He said he got really good at hitting like beer cans and shit back into the crowd.
I would definitely watch a highlight tape of that.
Hell yeah.
Man, this is way too much praise for Jim Cornette.
Yeah, he's a piece of shit, but like, whatever.
Next up, we've got a first blood match for the TV title. Dusty Rhodes versus Tully Blanchard. Blanchard is out first along with J.J. Dillon, and then we follow Dusty from his locker room to the ring.
Love that. Always love it.
Big fight entrance for Dusty.
Dusty has this great sense to him now. Like, his days as being a top guy are pretty much over. Like, the last really top thing that he did was, like, Starrcade the year before. Like, he's pretty
Once he beat Flair for the title, like, his character arc had wrapped itself up. Like, he conquered the mountain. Like, he climbed the mountain. He beat Ric Flair. He did it one more time. This is the Lion in Winter here.
But he's really entered into this, like, people's champion thing now, where he's just, like, a walking legend. So, like, as he walks out, and he walks out alone, there's nobody in the hallways, and, like, you can just hear, like, the rumble of the crowd over him as they wait for Dusty to come out, and it's very cool.
Yeah. I mean, the crowd, I'm sure that crowd noise was probably dubbed in, because they dubbed over his music. He would come out to, I think it's, like, what's the song called, You Can't Judge a Book by Looking at Its Cover?
Yeah.
Old Hank Williams song.
Yep.
Blanchard puts on headgear to protect his ears and forehead. The referee makes him take it off. Then J.J. Dillon smears like Vaseline on his forehead and the referee wipes it off.
Tully Blanchard is... It's a shame that he burned every single bridge on the face of the earth. Like, except for AEW, because he's back now. But was one of the most inventive and, like, all of the members of the Four Horsemen were bad, but Tully was the only one who was irredeemably bad.
What a gifted dickhead he was.
He was never going to turn babyface. No. There's no possible way to turn Tully Blanchard babyface.
Dusty proceeds to hit JJ with the bionic elbow and splits him wide open.
Love it.
It's a pretty good brawl, and then Dusty suplexes Tully and knocks down the ref. Dusty busts Tully open, but the ref is down. Tully then gets, you guessed it, a roll of quarters.
Now, Ron Garvin and Bubba Rogers did a pretty good job with the roll of quarters, but when Tully Blanchard hits Dusty with it, they explode everywhere. He knows how to work a roll of quarters.
JJ wipes the blood off Tully's head with a towel. And then
referee wipes Vaseline on his head.
And then the referee sees Dusty bleeding and awards the match to Tully.
In true babyface fashion, Dusty trips and falls over the ref so the ref sees him first.
Yeah, Dusty sells the hell out of this one. He's just agonizing here.
Yes, he is beyond furious. The fans are like ready to jump the guardrail and murder Tully Blanchard.
All right, it's time. We got the Skywalker match.
It's time to walk the skies.
The Road Warriors against the Midnight Express. It's Bobby Eaton and Dennis Condrey. I'm pretty sure Stan Lane replaces Condrey the year after this.
I really wish they had done a video promoting this one so that they could have explained the rules to it. And I think it would have gone something like, when two men live together in the sky.
One of those motherfuckers is going to get thrown off eventually. According to Wikipedia, Hawk had a broken leg here.
Why is he here? Why
did this match happen? Yeah.
Like, I can't even imagine a more dangerous thing you could have somebody do than be a 300-pound motherfucker who's not particularly agile to begin with, have a broken leg, and then put him 20 feet above the arena.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I would guesstimate the scaffold 12 to 15 feet above the ring, which is, yeah, close to 20 above the arena floor.
It's about the same height as, like, the tall ladder in WWE. So, like, when Jeff would do his jumps off of that shit, it's about the same as jumping off the scaffold.
It's the scaffold's probably 6 feet wide, I want to say.
I mean, not as wide as it should be.
No, it's rickety as hell. Like, there's railings, but it definitely looks like if you put your weight on the railing, it would break.
Here's the thing. Like, you could construct something that could possibly be something, right? Like, you construct, like, a 15-foot-wide scaffold that you could have, like, actual matches on, but it's suspended up there, so it feels super threatening. Like, just build, like, a whole ring above the ring, but with, like, no ropes, so it feels dangerous, right? But you could still do stuff. Or you could, like, make a whole bunch of, like, fucking bars and shit that they could, like, do spots on. I don't know. But what this is an actual painting scaffold that they just painted to look nice. That's all it is. And it's as rickety as a painting scaffold.
The Midnights stall for a while. They finally climb the scaffold. They get up there and nothing happens. Like, the guys can't move. They're scared shitless. And I don't blame them.
Like, I don't believe this territory has done anything like this. Like, you've mentioned that it was originally done in Memphis.
I think this was the first one ever in Crockett. It had been in Memphis. And then I think they had done some in Mid-South.
And here's the thing. It's not like they were working scaffold matches on the house shows coming in and learning how to work it. You can't do this a bunch of times. So, like, they don't know what to do. How do you work on a scaffold in a match?
You can't take any bumps.
Yeah. Every time somebody's going to take a bump off the scaffold, like, literally, like, they lay down. And then, like, one of the warriors lays down on top of them to help brace them so that they can swing down underneath to take the bump. It's the shittiest looking thing in the world.
Eaton ends up hanging off of Animal's leg, but he's able to grab the railing. There's some more brawling. Shivani at one point says, "This is absolutely spectacular," in, like, the flattest voice I've ever heard.
He's still in his innocent period, so you can't, like, you usually can't catch him admitting openly to the fans that what they're watching is bullshit.
This sucks ass. Yeah.
But in this one, you can kind of see it bleeding through.
The Express climb down to the lower level. They end up hanging off the bottom of the scaffold like they're monkey bars.
First of all, big ups to all the members of the Midnight Express who don't seem like they have great upper body strength, but, like, they genuinely, like, pull themselves up impressively a couple of times. Like, these are some strong dudes.
They both take, like, long but controlled falls down into the ring. Like, yes. I'm sure they were sore, but these both looked okay.
There's a way to do this. You can either take it as, like, a really hard back bump, like AJ style, or you can take it on your legs, but immediately, like, kind of push yourself backwards parkour style and roll it out. Yeah. And, like, they both choose the second, but, like, they both seem fine. That's fine. You just kind of crumple and it's okay.
And then the tragedy happens.
All right. So before you say what does happen, let's say what was supposed to happen. So Jim Cornette, who is more afraid of heights than anyone is afraid of anything, is supposed to gently be, like, put that, like, he's being held by the, like, I think Animal as he, like, slowly crawls his way underneath and hangs down.
Yeah.
Then Big Bubba Rogers is supposed to get into place underneath, and then he's supposed to swing back and forth three times, kick his legs up, and take a controlled back bump into Big Bubba Rogers' arms. Big Bubba catches him, like, tons of heat because he didn't actually take the bump. That's the idea.
Yeah.
Now what happens?
Cornette ends up hanging off the side of the scaffold. He does swing back and forth a couple times. Then he falls straight down at a terrifying speed. Bubba does not catch him. Cornette lands on his feet and destroys his knee.
Yes. Jim Cornette is not a wrestler. Like, for all the times he's probably taken bumps in his career or whatever, he sure don't know how to take this one.
Not, like, trained, not an athletic person.
There's a couple things you can do to help yourself. You can pull yourself up right before you go to give yourself a couple extra seconds in the air to brace yourself. You can do a lot of things. You know not to just put your legs down and try to put weight on them as you fall. Like, you know not to put your arms back to try to brace yourself because he'll snap them. And unfortunately, Big Bubba Rogers loses him in the lights. He literally said he could not see him because it was so bright looking up.
Yeah.
He is like a solid 5 feet away from Cornette.
Oh, he hits so hard. It's really bad.
You can hear him in the highest pitch voice imaginable screaming the F word over and over again.
Yeah. And then, like, they try to, like, walk him to the back, and he's like, no, I can't walk. I need you to carry me.
Yeah, like, no paramedics.
They don't send out medical assistance. Don't, like, they really, they need to get a stretcher out there and wheel him back, but that's not happening.
That's also part of the reality of Southern wrestling, though, is that, like, when heels get hurt, you don't send the paramedics.
No.
That
no,
gets
the paramedics are going to get shit thrown at them.
Yeah. People try to drive the ambulance off the road on the way to the hospital.
It's a miracle nobody jumped the rail in on this show.
It is. It's actually funny that we're talking about this now, because we're in this actual week that we're in right now. Yes. A fan jumped the railing and attacked Seth Rollins.
That was wild. What the fuck?
Well, actually, we found out what it was, and that's because somebody with a Twitter account pretending to be Seth Rollins extorted a ton of money from this guy. And this
God!
And this guy genuinely, who thinks, like, wrestling is real. Like, he was literally sending DMs to the fake Seth Rollins about, like, you're having such a hard time with Brock Lesnar. I always believed in you, man. You can do it. You can beat him. All this stuff. Gets all this money. He gets his girlfriend to write, like, a fake check for Seth Rollins, so she goes to jail. Like, there's all this shit.
Oh,
right?
My God, I didn't know any of this.
Yes, this just came out like a couple hours ago. And so this guy jumps the guard. He buys a ticket to the Barclays Center, jumps the rail and attacks Seth Rollins because he thinks the real Seth Rollins extorted money from him.
Drip King Seth Rollins blackmailed him.
This is the closest to old school Southern heat that any wrestler has ever had.
I thought Seth handled himself okay there. He got the guy in a guillotine.
Look, like, 40 referees came down and, like, dogpiled the guy. So, like, whatever was going to happen was going to happen. Seth could – it's just – it is funny, though, that this guy gave him, like, the Monty Brown pounce, and it was very funny.
I mean, that's the first time – that's the first time you've had somebody, like, get a hand on the wrestler in a long time, I feel like.
Mostly when people jump the guardrail, there's, like, a sense of self-consciousness or inebriation about them where they don't just think, like, oh, yeah, man, I can get in there and take him. Let's do this. This guy thought he was part of the fucking show. Like, he runs down the ramp like he's doing a run-in.
God, what a time to be alive.
Yes, but it's nice that we're talking about Southern wrestling, where shit like that happened all the time.
Oh, yeah, that was just like Tuesday in Muskogee.
Yeah, half the reason Jim Cornette had Big Bubba Rogers is so there really would be a guy who could take down fans. Somebody
who could actually protect him from the marks who were trying to kill him.
Yeah, it's really not a joke. People many times attempted to actually murder Jim Cornette. Tried to drive his car off the road, slashed his tires, like, put salt in his gas tank, like, chased him with knives.
People got stabbed. I've never heard of anyone being shot. I've heard of guns being pulled.
Yes. For whatever reason, like, actually using a gun was super taboo with all of this, which is nice, because otherwise some shit would have really happened.
Like, I heard well into the 90s, Cornette would, like, drive around. He would have, like, a gun under the seat of his car. Like, that's a Vince Russo story.
And, like, as crazy as Jim Cornette is in many ways, to some extent, you almost can't blame him.
I mean, by the 90s, I feel like he didn't need that. But, like, back in the 80s, yeah. Like,
especially since, like, if you're Big Bubba Rogers, people aren't going to try you. But if you're Jim Cornette,
everybody knows they can whoop that guy's ass.
Oh, yeah. Let's fucking find him in a gas station bathroom and beat his ass.
They once again show highlights of the Great American Bash tape.
Yay. They're just killing time. But they got to put the cage up.
Yeah.
They got to take the scaffold down and put the cage up.
No, because we're back to... We go back to Greensboro for the cage. They do have to get the... I mean, they had time to get the cage up. But they wouldn't put the cage up during the match because people – they probably wouldn't put the cage up while the match was going on because people are watching the other match on the screen.
That makes sense. As seamless as it is, I genuinely keep forgetting that they were switching back and forth.
Yeah.
Like, other than the announcers, you wouldn't really know, especially since, like, they have the lights off. This is during the era where only things lit is the ring, so, like, you can't really tell.
And then for some inexplicable reason, they roll the credits here in the middle of the show.
Yes, this is one of those production snafus. And like occasionally, I think there were like three or four times where they'd be like, all right, here's the next match. And then they'd like immediately cut away from the graphic and then bring it back up and then cut away from the graphic. I'm like, what are you guys doing?
Oh, man. Next up, it's the Greensboro main event for the NWA tag titles. The Rock and Roll Express defend against the Andersons. I believe this is the final Starrcade for Ole.
It seems like it should be. He's getting up there.
We'll miss him so much.
Yeah. Our favorite wrestler, Ole Anderson.
I kind of love Ole Anderson. Just the meanest stepdad imaginable.
Yeah. It's so funny when he is a member of this tag team with Arn, and Arn seems like the nice young man next to Ole. Any other group, Arn Anderson's the bad motherfucker, but next to Ole Anderson, he just seems like a plucky young upstart.
Like, literally, Arn was just breaking in, and he was Marty Lundy, and, like, Bill Watts saw him and was like, shit, you look just like Ole Anderson. And he called Ole, and he's like, hey, I got a guy, and he's like 6'4", 260 pounds, and he looks just like you. Can you do something with that?
And thus?
Yes.
And for whatever we want to say about Ole Anderson, too, like, he crafts Arn Anderson as a character. Like,
yeah.
Arn Anderson is just a refined version of Ole Anderson's character that he had for years and years.
Funny thing is, Ole Anderson was the same thing. He looked like Gene Anderson. So, like, okay, he'll be Gene Anderson's nephew or cousin or whatever.
It's just funny, like, stocky, bald pieces of shit.
Yeah.
Just kept getting the legacy handed down.
And now Arn's got an actual son wrestling.
And he looks exactly like him.
Yeah. And unlike Cody, he fucking listens to him.
Yeah. Gonna pull out his gat.
Rock and Roll are defending the titles here. It does feel like they should be challenging. That would be hotter.
Yes, completely agree.
It's a steel cage match, one fall to a finish. They tag in and out. Gibson gets his knee worked over for a while. Then he manages to tag out to Morton. Morton gets like one punch in before he gets run into the cage by Ole and worked over. Like, he's Ricky Morton. You know what's happening here.
It's funny, like, when you go a while without seeing the Rock and Roll Express, it really is funny just how amazing they are at this.
Yeah.
Like, there's nobody. Like, the Rockers, who were literally an attempt to recreate this exact gimmick to the extent that, like, the Rock and Roll Express looks so much like the Rockers in this match that it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And, like, Shawn Michaels, who might be the greatest seller who ever lived, is not a patch on Ricky Morton in that role. Not, it's a joke. It's not even comparable.
Morton blades as he's getting beat down. Arn comes off the second rope, but Morton gets him with a fist to the gut and then a DDT. Ole tags himself in. He runs Morton into the cage, follows up with the shoulder breaker. Morton hits a knee lift and both guys are down. Ole tags in, starts working over Morton's arm. Morton keeps getting cut off. Morton then makes a comeback. He gets Ole in a small package, but Arn breaks up the pin. Ole goes to slam Morton. Gibson comes back with a drop kick, and that's enough for the pin. That was good, but not what I was expecting. I was expecting an all-time classic.
Yeah, I was expecting like a knockdown, drag out, bloody, like murder fest. Like, it's not really what we got.
Yeah. Just, you know, a little bit of a letdown. I don't know. Ole was definitely getting old here, but that's not the issue. I think it was just kind of an anticlimax.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the last two matches on this show are not what you would have thought they would have been.
Yeah. All right. It's main event time. We're back to the Omni for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. Ric Flair defends against Nikita Koloff. Flair is out first. He looks amazing in his purple robe. He is a fully formed Ric Flair at this point. I feel like that might be the first time I say that during these Starrcades.
Yeah. Like, we've seen him go from, like, the young babyface, like, crown star to, like, he had done the Horseman the year before and like really made that gigantic heel turn, but he wasn't fully crystallized yet. This is him at the height of his powers. This was the Ric Flair he was born to be.
Okay. Before the match, they play a tribute package to Magnum TA, which heavily features his mom. And I don't know if the song they used here was the original song, but tonally it felt very much like a romantic video package because of the music they used. So bad.
It absolutely looked like a romantic vignette about Magnum TA falling in love with his own mother. It was very strange.
Oh man,
I don't look. It's also very weird to be doing that here because this match did not need as a reminder of what the match could have been.
Yeah, what we all wanted.
Yeah, that does not help anything at all.
Like I said, Nikita gets a lot of boos for his entrance.
And again, part of that I think is just that they didn't have time to turn him fully.
Yeah.
Also, part of that is just that he's not Magnum. Wanted Magnum. A lot of people bought these tickets to see Magnum fight Ric Flair because it was only a month out. Like, they would have already bought him.
Yeah. Nikita keeps overpowering Flair in the early stages of the match. He goes for the lariat, but Flair ducks it. Nikita goes over the top rope. He comes up holding his knee. Of course, Flair zeroes right in on the knee. He goes for the figure four, but Nikita turns it over. They fight out to the floor. Flair slams Nikita into the scaffold and Nikita blades. Flair follows up with the knee drop. Nikita makes his comeback. He throws Flair out to the floor. Flair goes over the top and he hits the scaffold and blades. So we got double juice here.
That's probably good. You needed something to get this going.
Back in the ring, Nikita hits a shoulder block. He knocks Flair into Tommy Young, who once again goes down. Nikita follows up with the Russian sickle, but there's no referee to make the count. Flair hits Koloff with a knee to the back. Nikita powers out. He goes for another Russian sickle, but Flair once again ducks and he hits the referee. Tommy Young gets back in the ring. Koloff shoves him, and fuck me, that's a disqualification.
Yep.
Oh, what a bad finish.
I mean, look.
Even for 1986, to do just like a straight-up DQ in the main event of Starrcade.
I mean, if you're going to... I don't see why you don't just do the Dusty finish here, right? Like...
Again?
But I mean, like, you got to do something feel-good here.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, even if you have Flair beat him clean, and that sucks, at least that's the worst thing you can do after a four-hour fucking show. Is to just fuck the fans and be like, well, you didn't need to stay for this. Which, by the way, apparently, according to reports, the Greensboro crowd who were supposed to be watching it on the monitor after their show, after their match ended, just started leaving in droves during the match. Didn't stay to see the end.
It was a disappointing match. It was not what I was hoping for.
Yep, same. I mean, I don't really know what I expected. This is the first match Nikita had ever wrestled babyface in his career.
Yeah, I mean, I was hoping for Lex Luger versus Ric Flair, but that was unrealistic.
Yeah, I mean, that's just... And, like, they had time to plan for that, to prepare. Like, what do you even do? Like, and if you're Flair, like... Look, he's already one of the greatest here, but he's not carry a bunch of bullshit to a great match Ric Flair yet. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is.
And then we get a massive locker room clearing brawl. This was cool.
I did love this. Like, this is the shit.
Did we get to see the Raging Bull here?
Yes, he was there.
Yeah. They all fear the Raging Bull.
Yeah, and they should. There's two dangerous men in this promotion. One's got hands of stone. One's got hands of fire.
And then they roll the highlight package and we're out. It's a revered show. I mean, look, I try to evaluate these shows in the context of their time. I don't know if fans would have been disappointed on this night, but this is not as good a show as I feel like it should have been.
I mean, ending any show in any era with a disqualification in the main event is not it's bad. Like, there's no circumstances in which that's not bad. In terms of, like, the rest of the show, there certainly was a feel that this was an epic, big-time show. So I'll certainly give them that. And it wasn't garbage, but it was – nothing was what I wanted it to be, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, just – I mean, look, I'm sure people were excited to see the scaffold match. It was horrible, but they got to see the baby – they got to see the heels fall off the scaffold. I guess that's what they paid to see.
And it's still like a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Like, it's – yeah. It's not Hell in a Cell, but imagine the first time you went to see a Hell in a Cell, it'd be like, whoa, this is crazy.
Yeah. I think, yeah, I'd say the fans in Atlanta probably got their money's worth. I don't think the fans in Greensboro did.
Yeah. Oh, I completely agree. The fans in Greensboro got fucked.
Yeah. So, yeah. And as I said, unbelievably, this is the last, like, proper Thanksgiving Starrcade. The year after this is a debacle, and then they have to move it to Christmas time.
Yep. And it's never quite the same again.
Oh, God. It's never even close to. I mean, like, as much as maybe we didn't love all of these shows, like, they were special. Like, this was something. Like, this was as big as the first couple WrestleManias.
And I really loved the good thing about having two different venues for Starrcade, especially on the Thanksgiving thing, is that, like, you could always do, like, the Omni or a different place or something like that, but there would always be a space, like, the Mecca, to make the pilgrimage to Greensboro. Like, I loved that representation of, like, their history. Like, Greensboro will always be home, but also we can branch out and do this other stuff. And, in fact, if they had done that in 87 and just done it from one from Greensboro and one from Chicago, I don't see why that wouldn't have been successful. But they just – they put all their money in expanding into Chicago, and it was a disaster.
It was a huge mistake to take it out of the South. I think the fans in Greensboro and Atlanta took it as a betrayal.
And it was. It was a betrayal. And it was a shitty show. But, yeah. I mean, we're going to talk about that.
All kinds of things go wrong the next year in Chicago, and we're going to be covering that next time. Unbelievably, the main event is Ric Flair versus Ronnie Garvin.
Yeah, here's the thing. Like, as much as we talked about how the Magnum TA thing, like, destroys this card, this is still a big show with big stars. They couldn't get the main event right because they didn't have time. But you feel like if they had had 6 months to put something else together, they would have figured it out. By the time we get to 87, we are already seeing, like, uh-oh, things are wrong. Things are wrong, wrong, wrong.
Yeah. Also, we've unbelievably got another Skywalker's match.
Another Skywalker's match!
Rock and Roll versus Midnight.
Oh, Jesus. And an invasion. That's what they have going for them here. They are being invaded by the brand new promotion they just bought, the UWF.
Unfortunately, not that UWF.
So that would have kicked ass to see Jimmy Snuka and Mick Foley and Sid running in.
It's a lot of the same guys from that UWF, though.
Yeah, Steve Williams, principally.
Steve Williams, the only man who was the champion of both UWFs.
That's right. What a king.
So, yeah, all that and more next time on the LawCast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next time.